You're listening to Ride Along, EMT School. I'm Mike.
And I'm Max. We're two students navigating EMT school, bringing you along week by week.
And I'm Jonathan, paramedic, bringing real-world perspective.
Join us as we share the lessons, challenges, and stories from EMT school, and hear insights from those already living the EMS life. Welcome to the Ride Along.
And we're here. Welcome to episode 10 of
the Ride Along EMT School Podcast. We're coming back at you again. Episode, yep. Wow, we've done 10 of these already?
10 episodes.
Technically, well, there's an 11th episode.
There is.
There was a secret, unreleased, redacted first episode.
If you want to really see that, email Mike at...
Well, I mean, it's not that interesting. We did that test.
We did
episode one, and then we redid episode one because then we realized everything that we talked about in that episode was what we meant to talk about in the next episode.
Yes.
With a bunch of context that wasn't there. Yes. In that first recording. So we totally...
We tortured ourselves for you.
For you.
To make this a better production. So you're welcome.
But yeah, so we... There is technically 11. Oh, 12 if you count the trailer.
True.
That that I made for the thing. So it's like we're going pretty strong.
I would say so. And we're flying missing man, except for this time it's not me.
Yes. Unfortunately, we have we are without Jonathan tonight.
No sage wise advice.
Yep. I think that's going to be a challenge for us. He's probably the biggest draw of the podcast itself. Being the expert and the guy who actually has real world experience on here,
we could always do is just refer to the blank space and no voice and ask questions into the nothingness.
We could do that.
We're not going to do that, but no, we could.
That wouldn't necessarily yield many results. I don't think.
So what are we covering tonight? In tonight's episode,
we are covering the class that we had on vitals.
So very important.
This is all about the proof of life. Mm-hmm. So that's what vital signs do. They tell you how a person's doing. It's the hard evidence, right? It's quantitative.
Nice.
Not quality, it's quantitative data to kind of give a status of a patient's health, right?
Yeah.
So how to obtain those and why they're important.
Exactly. And I mean, the reality being is that being on the ambulance or even in someone's home before that point, it's going to determine how you care for them. It's going to determine your approaches. It's going to determine whether or not this is something that is a rush or not. You need to give that information to the hospital.
Yeah.
Over the radio before you arrive so they know what they're dealing with. I mean, it's kind of the bedrock of what you're doing from the point of contact on.
Yeah, I would say two very important trends that we're seeing so far in EMT school are moving patients.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like we're going to be doing a lot of that as EMTs and taking vitals. It seems like those two things go hand in hand and they are the things that are the core competencies of being an EMT. A lot of, and I think we're going to get a lot of practice, practical practice in those things. We've already gotten a bunch in the moving.
We have.
And the last couple classes that we've been in, we've had a bunch of vitals practice.
And we've assaulted our families.
Yes. I've, don't use assault.
Assault's wrong. We have pressed our families into service,
yes,
helping us learn
better. We have
better.
Impressed them. impressed in the old sense of like, I'm going to impress you into service.
Yes.
Not impress as in, wow, they're impressed with my vital taking skills because nobody should be impressed with those.
Well, it depends on how fast and how efficient you get.
That's true. I was doing better last night, but... We'll talk about that some because we've had other classes where we've gotten some practice in taking the vitals.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the next episode is going to be initial assessment. So all of the vital signs then start rolling into the initial assessment itself.
So stay tuned.
Yep. Before we get any further,
yep. We
should probably take a moment to talk about our sponsors, which tonight is not a sponsor.
Correct. It's an organization that we're trying to spotlight.
Yes.
People that are doing good things.
Right. So every once in a while, we like to take a moment and shine a little bit of light on organizations that deserve it, that help the EMS community. So instead of a sponsor this episode, we're taking a moment to highlight an organization that's been shaping emergency medicine and benefiting the lives of patients for decades. Today, we're spotlighting the American Heart Association. Since 1924, the AHA has been fighting heart disease and stroke, investing in life-saving research, training millions in CPR, and setting the standards EMTs use for emergency cardiac care. The American Heart Association pursues a clear and powerful goal: to be a relentless force for longer, healthier lives. They're breaking barriers in science, spreading knowledge, and giving people the tools to save each other when it matters most. Learn more at heart.org, whether it's signing up for a local CPR class, volunteering at a community event, or supporting ongoing research. You can help save lives, because every beat counts.
Yep.
I'm a fan of the AHA. They've certainly had a huge impact on a lot of lives, including, pretty much everyone that's experienced or, you know, had CPR like performed on them in some way, shape, or form has been like guided by the American Heart Association for like the last 30 years or something like that.
And just the fact that they have brought that simple thing to attention and to kind of common knowledge. Like, you may not know how to perform it properly, but you know what CPR is. I don't think there's anyone that doesn't know what CPR is.
Yeah.
So the fact that they're exposing more people to that and the idea of that preventive care that literally saves lives, it's huge. Just that small piece alone of what they've done is huge.
It is huge. And there's a few of these kind of like, like tent pole, I think is the, kind of foundational organizations within the EMS and emergency medical community. I think the AHA in medicine in general, is super impactful.
Yep.
So, I think they do great work and, deserve whatever support that we can muster for them. Yep. So thank you, AHA, for doing what you do. So what do we got going on tonight?
So we're talking about vital signs. We're talking about basically what they are, how to take them, what we learned in class. And also we have a tool of the trade that relates very closely to vital signs.
We do, yes.
One of the clear and leading tools to be used during it.
And what is that tool called?
Here we go, people. Sphygmomanometer.
Manomina.
blood pressure cuff.
It is a blood pressure cuff.
And we're going to go into detail. We're going to mention it throughout the episode, and we're also going to go into detail when we get to that.
Yeah, section. We're probably not going to say the word sphygmomanometer.
No. I've said it way too many times.
It just rolls off the tongue.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, I'm actually countering myself, because I said in an earlier episode I would only say it the one time, and I've now said it at least.
Well, I'm sure you'll get used to it. That's the name of the tool. So stay tuned towards the end of the episode for Tools of the Trade, which will be the sphygmomanometer. But we like to kick off episodes with the medical term of the week, because it's probably a key concept that we're going to be chatting about a bunch this episode. And for this week, it is the term of baseline, which is there's apparently way more to know about baselines other than Cliff Burton played the best of all time.
Kind of.
Because he is the best.
Okay.
Like, well, you know, some people say Geddy Lee. They're wrong.
Yeah, they're definitely wrong.
Also acceptable answers are Paul McCartney and Flea.
Yeah.
You know, but it's all about Cliff. Come on, Metallica, baby. So baseline is a core concept to vital signs.
Yeah.
And it's a term that refers to the very first set of vitals that you get on a patient. It can also refer to that patient's typical vital sign.
Right.
So like you'll hear people kind of refer to baseline in more of a casual sense of like, hey, is that your baseline? Meaning right. if you have an abnormally high blood pressure, Max does. I've taken his vitals a few times. I do know that he has hypertension, which is the term for high blood pressure.
Yes.
So like if I take a high blood pressure off of Max and I say, hey, is your baseline normally high? He can say yes, because he knows he normally has high blood pressure, right?
Correct.
So the baseline is what you're comparing to. Now, in any other type of environment, it's going to be the first thing that you get.
Yeah.
Because that's the only information that you have.
And as an EMT, you need to know what they're referring to. If someone's asking you what their baseline is and you go into a spiel about their history, you might have a confused person that's not understanding what you're talking about. Like if you're an EMT, you have to understand what that term means for the medical providers.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, where does it really come into play? Well, any time you take a vital of all the different vitals, and we'll talk about those in a minute, because this whole episode is going to be talking about vitals.
Exactly.
But each one is a snapshot in time, right? Mm-hmm. It is what that patient is doing right now. And that is important. It gives you a status of what they're doing. But the thing that's even more important is the trend.
Yes.
So you need to have a baseline so that you can start comparing your subsequent data, your subsequent findings to that baseline to know, are they improving? Are they getting worse? And improvement and worse can be relative, you know, like a heart rate raising can be improving if it's a low heart rate, or, you know, a heart rate lowering can be improving if it's, you know, if they originally started with a high heart rate. So you have to know where the patient's starting to know, okay, if their heart rate is lowering, that's a good or a bad thing.
Like if my baseline is 165 over 80 and I was like, oh, that's high. And then my next reassessment has me normal. Like, okay, well, he's improving. Or if the next assessment again is lower than that, then even though I'm starting high, I'm trending going low.
Right. So he could be blowing right past quote unquote normal.
Yep.
Because the normal BP for an adult is like 120 over 80. Like mm-hmm. that's the golden number. Although from what we hear of people who've been out there in the real world, that nobody really has that number nowadays. Like very few, because this is America and we like things like bacon.
Bacon is wonderful.
It is. It's a great food. It's probably not great for, you know, the BP.
I refuse to believe that.
Well, so baseline, very important. Baseline. It's like the musical term, the baseline is giving you the cadence. It's giving you the structure. It's allowing you to know how far you're going, whether things are going up or down. So it is a fitting term for kind of understanding
absolutely
how vitals are going, right? So, you know, without that baseline, it's impossible to judge if things have gotten way worse or way better or slightly changed, slightly less, and how often it's being taken is going to be very, you know, important to know.
It's also, as you reassess, it may key you into, did I take an inappropriate or a wrong baseline vital?
Yeah.
You know, it kind of gives you that cue of, okay, wait a minute, I really need to reassess this again because I could have been mistaken. Because trying to do that in the back of a ambulance or amongst a bunch of screaming family or, you know, just in general, people that are, when trauma's happening, generally people aren't happy and smiling. And
I could imagine it being very difficult in this situation.
So,
But really, the key takeaway is think of it like the before picture. And if you get data that is contradictory to it, like if you're getting a bunch of trends and then all the trends after that baseline are, you know, contradictory to that original baseline, you may need to throw that first baseline out and take a new baseline and then use that as your comparative data so that you're trending, like you're tracking the trends. And that can be very important for understanding, do I have enough time to treat this patient? Like, do I need to make decisions to make interventions here? Do I have the time to wait for ALS, advanced life support, to arrive if they need it? Or do I need to get this patient into an ambulance right now?
Yep.
And get them to a hospital. All those things come into play. Yep. So very important.
Exactly.
So baseline.
Baseline.
Yeah.
So the topic for tonight is vital signs. Why do we check the vital signs and what do they tell us about the patient?
We check the vital signs because the book tells us to.
Exactly.
Well, you know, it's funny because I didn't really think about this before, but it's almost like checking vital signs is like the most experience that I've had in this kind of field, because I've been checking vital signs for my whole life. You know, like one of the first things you do as a kid is you stick that thermometer in your mouth. You stick it under your tongue when your parents say you're sick. That's getting vital signs, right? Like
100%.
Checking a pulse. I remember learning to check a pulse when I was, you know, a kid. Like, mm-hmm. I don't even know when. I was probably in the Scouts. But like, I remember the idea of somebody teaching me how to get a radial pulse, a carotid pulse, like when I was super young.
We had a lifeguard show us, and then we played a game where we got a weighted thing, went to the bottom of the pool, and who could get the lowest pulse rate?
Oh.
One. Like, who could hang out at the bottom of the pool the longest to get the lowest pulse rate possible?
That sounds
dumb.
Dangerous.
Incredibly dumb.
Yeah, and I don't understand why hanging out at the bottom of the pool would lower your pulse rate.
We were seven.
Yeah, I don't think that's a thing.
It seemed like the thing we should do.
Well, it'll lower your pulse rate eventually when your body stops, like, perfusing.
Yes.
And so, yeah, that's just called drowning.
Yeah.
And we haven't gotten there yet, but I'm sure that's going to be one of the things that we go over in EMT school. You know, and like, even from not the hard data side, like, okay, I'm going to put a blood pressure cuff on, or I'm going to, you know, like, actually count beats per minute of heartbeat. Like, we look at vital signs, or some of the more obvious vital signs, every time we see somebody.
Sure.
Right. So respiration rate,
mm-hmm.
like, we may not be counting it, but we have an innate sense of understanding vitals. Or some vitals, just by the way somebody looks.
Well, there's all these cues around the eyes, around the face. What does their skin look like? Are they sweating profusely?
Skin's an easy one, right? Like, it's the most apparent.
Sure.
Like, how your skin looks. Are you cyanotic?
Yep.
Or diaphoretic or sweaty is, you know, are you cold and clammy? Like, we see those things and go, that person looks terrible.
Because I think it's hard to look at someone that is really sick and not, like, recognize it. There's an animal monkey response there that your brain is telling you that person's not well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And we can see, you know, there are some vital signs that we can see right away.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some that we have to start digging into a little bit further. And they could be so super important in understanding how a patient's doing.
Sure.
So while respiratory rate, very easy to see, you may not even need to touch a patient to be able to see their respiratory rate. You could just watch them and see how many breaths per minute that they're taking.
Yep. Or whether or not they're doing a labored breath, tripoding, where they're hunched over.
Yep.
You know, all those things are very visual.
Yes. The harder ones are things like pulse, where, you know, I mean, maybe you could see somebody's pulse, like if they have like a really strong pulse in like a neck or something like that, but that's probably not often.
and probably not a good thing.
Or do you ever see somebody who's got like a pulsing vein in their arm? Like, jacked bodybuilders and stuff. That's easy. Like, oh, you just put your finger right on, mm-hmm. like, you know, right away that what their pulse is. But you start to using tools.
Sure.
Like a
blood pressure cuff.
Well, that's for blood pressure. No. For listening.
Oh, stethoscope.
You need a stethoscope to hear the heartbeat.
Yep.
Or, you know, to
lung sounds.
Yeah. Or for lung sounds, but
abdominal sounds.
Or abdominal sounds. Like there is a lot of stuff we haven't learned yet on the stethoscope. But you can get a lot of information from auscultation.
Listening. Yes.
The stethoscope helps with hearing the heart. Mm-hmm. But you don't even necessarily need that. You could just get a pulse from like palpating a patient, right?
Yep.
The blood pressure cuff, like you can't really start getting a quote unquote blood pressure until you start using tools.
Correct.
So that's where, you know, we start needing things
to
bring with us to be able to get the data. And there's a couple of different ways you can get blood pressures, mainly, you know, either listening to it, so using a stethoscope to hear the beats, hear the pulses in the radial, I know what I'm doing. Like, I know the thing now, I just don't know the terminology, and it's really frustrating. But like, to be able to hear the heartbeat as you're increasing the pressure of the cuff.
Yep.
So, or you can palpate it. Yep. So like, but you still need a pressure sensitive or a calibrated pressure device, yep, to be able to know exactly how much pressure you're inducing on the arm. What else? What other type of vitals do we have, Max?
Well, so we have pulse, which we've already talked about. Respiration, we already talked about. We have pupils.
Yeah.
So
that's something you don't really need a tool for normally.
What your eyes are doing, how your pupils are contracting and dilating, it tells you a lot about we still have yet to learn some of the deeper meanings. But it's going to tell you things, what's going on in that person's brain, whether they have an injury. It can tell you their mental state at times. It can tell you whether or not they're inebriated. So like, the pupils are telling you a bigger story. And one of the tools we use is a small pen light.
Yeah.
And just basically shining in the light and then seeing how those pupils react to that bright light.
And it's, you know, like what it means. We have so much more to learn.
Yeah, we've only just touched on
what
that.
They indicate is, yeah, we're just starting to scratch, yeah, the surface. But the important thing is to understand what it is that we're looking at, and that is the actual diameter and the change in the pupils,
yep,
and how they react to light.
Exactly.
Because those can be indicators for other things. Yep. And then one or a couple of other vital signs, which technically, I believe as an EMT is not considered to be, or I think in the medical field is not considered to be a vital sign. Oxygen saturation, yep, is one of the ones that we talk about constantly, because it can be so informative as to how well a patient's lungs and heart are working together to show how much oxygen is in the blood. And there's a bunch of other things that we learned in terms of like false indicators and, mm-hmm, and other factors there, but it's a really good, like, it's a really good indicator of performance,
yeah,
of the cardiovascular, exactly, and respiratory system.
How well are the lungs working? How well are the lungs working at getting oxygen to your cells,
yeah,
to the blood? You know, there's critical numbers that you need to look for pulse ox, anywhere from 94 to 100.
Yeah,
There are all these different rates. Different things mean different things. Different stages of that number mean different things. But again, it's a very quick, easy thing for you to put on someone's finger. Anyone that's been to a doctor's office has had it done.
Yes.
You know, so it's another thing that as an EMT, you have to – it's another tool in your toolbox to be able to tell what is going on with this person.
Right. And then one other vital sign, which again isn't technically a vital sign like in the traditional sense, but blood glucose level, mm-hmm, which can be a huge indicator of a bunch of different problems, and help you kind of diagnose some things that you can help either treat on scene or at least relay to higher medical care. So we have five core vital signs that we're practicing very often.
Yes.
The pulse, the respirations, skin, pupils, and blood pressure.
Yeah.
With kind of two bonus ones being the oxygen saturation and blood glucose level.
Yep.
And we're getting some practice in all of them.
A lot of practice.
A lot.
Which is, this is the part of the class for me that is so much fun. I love the doing things. It's just, this is where I live, is in the doing things.
Yeah.
I love this part of it.
These skills are ones that this is what I was looking to learn. Like,
yeah,
not like two, yep, two things that I was very much hoping to get out of EMT school. One, the ability to assess a patient, mm-hmm, better. And then to then know the right thing to do next. Cause sometimes, right, those are two separate things, like to be able to assess versus to make the decisions on how to treat or transport or like what action comes next. But the assessment is like, you know, super important in every situation.
Yes. It is the foundation for everything else going forward.
Yeah. And to make a good assessment, you have to be able to take good vitals.
Yeah. And it can be challenging. Depending on who it is, you could have someone that has a really tough pulse to find radially. It happened, in class.
As a matter of fact, we can talk about pulse first.
Sure.
Kind of in depth, of those vital signs. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is very hard to palpate, right?
Yes. So palpate. Explain palpate.
Palpate. That's the process of making paper, right? So you have to first break up a tree. Pulpate.
I think it's pulpate.
I like a low level of palpation in my orange juice. No, okay. So palpate. That's the emperor from Star Wars.
Part of the name of the emperor from Star Wars.
It's Emperor Palpate.
Palpatine.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Bad jokes.
So bad. Palpate means to feel. Yes. Like it's literally the term for feeling, or pressing, or manual manipulation of the body to get data through your hands.
Yes.
I think that's my takeaway from it.
Cause 100%.
Cause you can palpate, and there's usually pressure involved with palpation. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to kind of get in there a little bit, and assessing trauma, injuries, things like that all have palpation
involved. Yep. But it literally is a long word for touching, like using your hands.
Touchy-feely.
Palpate, palm.
Poking. It's more poking, right? Like, because you're kind of getting
pressing,
in there.
Pressing.
I would
say pressing. Yeah.
Poking, I guess. Yeah. It's not.
It's not pleasant.
It's not pleasant. Yeah. It's rude to it poke. Is. So we can get pulses by palpating.
Yes.
We can also get pulses by a couple of other ways.
You threw another term out there earlier that you could also identify.
You can auscultate.
Which is?
Listen through a stethoscope.
God forbid they just use... Listen. No,
although I find the important thing is to make sure that you have the ability to find it in multiple ways in case one mm-hmm. of them isn't working. Palpation is kind of the most common. Auscultation is another way you can get it. Mm-hmm. And then we also have a very easy way to do it, and that is through tools that automatically get it.
Yeah. Like right now, I could pick up Mike's wrist because he has a watch that is showing his current beats per minute, which is 76.
76 beats per minute. Oh, like I have my heart rate all the time.
So like, do you have these tools that you could have on you at any given time that not only will tell you what your pulse rate is, but will actually give you, most of them will have an app so you can see your history.
Yes. Trends in your pulses. Actually, I really enjoy looking at mine when I do physical activities. Just to see how out of shape I am.
Yeah. So, like, we have all these different ways, but ultimately, rudimentary, use your hands. Put your fingers where they go. And there's different spots in the body we can get a pulse from.
Right. And there's, I mean, you could theoretically get a pulse from almost anywhere. As long as you have access to an artery. I think you can do it with a vein as well. Don't quote me on that. But...
Where are you, Jonathan?
Yeah, I know. Jonathan would be great right now. So arteries, the reason why we palpate arteries is because they have pressure in them.
Yes.
And they, and you know, the pressure is what's kind of translating the heartbeat through the pressure waves in the actual mm-hmm. blood that's going through the vessels, right? So anywhere that you have access to an artery and that artery can be pressed up against something else inside the body, usually a bone.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really the only hard things inside of a body, you're lightly squeezing that artery from both sides to be able to feel the pressure as it's moving through.
And that's representing the contractions that a heart is doing.
Your heart's pumping, and it's sending blood out. Yep. And that blood is then increasing the pressure within mm-hmm. the vessels.
So for a conscious patient, we generally use radial pulse.
So radial pulse is great.
Which is the wrist?
Yeah. Well, so it's anywhere on the radial artery, right?
Mm-hmm.
So typically that's behind the thumb,
mm-hmm.
The radial pulse there. You can get we've been getting radial pulses from below the bicep mm-hmm. for things like blood pressure.
Yep.
So you can get a radial pulse there. The radial artery goes through the whole arm.
Right.
If the radial isn't working,
they're unconscious.
Or they're unconscious. But you can get a radial pulse from an unconscious patient. Like they have a pulse, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's going to be happening throughout the body. It's just which ones are the most accessible, right? The carotid, I think, is probably number two.
Yes.
Right. Like if you don't have that one and you need to get a pulse right now, I'm going for the carotid. It seems like that's what they were kind of teaching us in class.
And if you have a child, then you would go for the brachial pulse, which is under the bicep.
Right. Yeah. So brachial is up here on the top of the arm. Kids don't have strong radial pulses. So the brachial is kind of the preferred in most situations. But if either one of those isn't accessible or you're not successful palpating it, the backup was always the carotid. And the carotid is it's in your neck, and this is a situation where you're not pressing up against a bone. You're pressing up against the cartilage that's in your neck. So that kind of like cartilaginous tissue.
You mean you don't want to press straight through the spine so you find a bone?
No, I don't think you're pressing through to the spine. But like your carotid runs up the side of your neck. Mm-hmm. So you use two fingers and you kind of press in on the side of your your voice box, right? Like your
windpipe.
Your windpipe, all that. Man, this is why we need Jonathan. We need like the epiglottis. That's a term. That's one of the things in there.
It is.
Your trachea. Like you're not pushing up against the trachea because that would be bad.
But if you touch the structure of your neck, you have where the Adam's apple is and your windpipe. That's that kind of obvious structure in the front and the middle. Across from that, you have a musculature, and there's like a divot right in between on both sides.
Yeah, and there's a you could feel like as soon as you put your finger in there, you feel that divot, and you can feel a pulse right away. Like I think it's the easiest one to find.
It's almost like that's the most important pulse. Like for some reason, it's like you really feel, it's almost like the heart's trying to pump blood to something that's important.
Your mouth, obviously. Because people want to hear us talk. It's the most important feature we have.
Absolutely.
No, it's your brain. Like it's got a big old, pipeline of blood right to your brain.
All right. And then there's other places you can also feel a pulse.
Yep. So basically, like I said before, anywhere that, or at least this is what they were telling us, like anywhere that there's an artery that's going through, you have the ability to palpate it, so you have a big one that goes through your legs. You have the femoral artery. And that can be accessed at a few different locations. I think like just below the hips. Mm-hmm. And you can also get it, I believe, behind the knee.
Yeah, and there's like they identified like a triangle identification thing of some kind. But like if you push where kind of the leg hits the hip in the middle, you're going to find it.
Yeah.
And there's other places too.
Yeah. So like, the appendages have a bunch of points where you can get reliable pulses. A couple more in the legs though that they pointed out, one being the dorsalis pedis.
Yes.
Which, if we go back to episode 2, 3, 4, anatomical. The anatomy.
Yeah, the anatomy.
The dorsalis side of the foot is the top of the foot.
Makes no sense.
I know. But that's what they call it.
I know. I know.
And the pedis is the foot. So the dorsalis pedis is the top of the foot.
Yep.
And there's a way to get it. There's a spot where you can get the pulse from one of the vessels there. And then also on the foot is the medial malleolus.
He did that pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, some of that these terms, nice, man, they're killing me. So, the malleolus is the ball on your ankle
on the inside.
Well, there's two malleoluses, right? There's the medial.
Mm-hmm.
And lateral.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Nice job.
Yes. Jesus. So on the inside, the medial malleolus, there's a palpation spot for one of the arteries in there. So, and I'm sure there's more.
Yeah.
Like, there's arteries and veins all over the head, all over the body that you can get a pulse from.
Yeah. But as an EMT, you need to know the majors so that you can take proper vital signs.
And if you're not getting one, you got to be able to get it from somewhere else. That's really the important thing. Like you have to be able to work the problem. You can't just be like, well, I can't get a pulse.
And whether you like it or not, there's a ticking clock that you have to keep in mind.
And then once you find it, there's a couple of things you got to keep in mind.
Just ignore it, right?
Well, once you find it, it's good. You know, was it there? Yes. It's a binary answer, right? Yes or no. There's qualitative answers for the Pulse 2 that they informed us about. So rhythm is one of them. So is it regular or irregular? Erratic?
Yeah.
You know, like does it seem to keep time or does it keep changing? Because though that could be indicative of something, it could be a red flag.
Right.
Although we did find out in class that, in younger adults.
Under 25,
there are some instances where in exertion of activities and with breath, with like respirations, sometimes that can change the heart rate, like make it irregular, which is super unnerving. And most of the people in our class are of that age group.
So they all can do it.
I think so. I mean, I've definitely felt a few pulses in this class where it was like,
oh yeah.
Did that change?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Like he's holding he every single time we were doing vital signs, the one student was asking me questions and I was taking his pulse, and every single time he asked me a question, it changed. Every single time he asked me a question.
It's weird. Like I didn't think that was a thing, but like your pulse rate can change based off of your breathing.
Yeah.
And then not just the rhythm, but the force.
Yeah.
The quality, like how strongly your pulse is coming through. So I believe the two terms that they taught us were thready.
Mm-hmm.
Thready being like weak and like uninspired. You have an uninspired pulse.
You, sir, have an uninspired pulse.
And then the other term was bounding.
Yes.
So like very strong, you know, I guess bounding, like it's going to bound out of the skin.
Yes.
So like, how does it feel? Does it feel, you know, do they typically have a thready pulse? That might be the case.
And I think the quality is one of those things for sure on reassessment. Like that's going to tell you something too.
It could be.
You know what I mean? Because you have that baseline, but when you go for the reassessment of the vital signs, that quality portion to it, I think in changes in that is going to be way more noticeable.
Mm-hmm. And then like, so I know this is, we haven't necessarily learned this in class yet, but I've been listening to some other podcasts as
you
well.
Cheated on us?
How yeah. Dare you, sir? I like to learn. As a matter of fact, shout out to Basically EMS. They're a good podcast. I like listening to them. I've gone through like six or seven episodes so far, and it's a couple of it's a group of paramedics out in Idaho, and they talk all different types of subjects. Nice. One of the recent episodes I was listening to is like cardiac emergencies or cardiac assessments. Maybe it's chest assessments. I forget which one it is, but they were talking about aortic dissection like aneurysms, aortic, like, you know, when an aorta starts tearing. And like they mentioned this in class the other night of if you ever have a patient that's saying they feel like there's a tearing sensation inside their chest, that's hospital bad.
Now,
that's really bad because it's usually indicative of the aorta tearing. However, one of the they were talking about there is that one of the other signs is unequal pulses. So this is why it's important to assess the pulse in both, on both sides of the body, because if you have like your aorta is malfunctioning, or if you have a tear or something like that, it can cause pressure differences in the vessel system on both sides of in the cardiovascular system on both sides of the body. So you could have a strong pulse on one side and almost no or weak pulse on the other.
That's another sign of hospital now.
Yeah, that could be like, hey, and that could also be other things too, which we don't know yet. But I think they mentioned a few the other night in terms of like an unequal pulse can be multiple things and things that you need to be aware of and be able to kind of relay.
Yep.
So pulse, super pulse, important. It's super almost important. It's the vital sign that directly relates to the one main piece of your body that has to keep moving.
There's the stuff that you need moving through your body, and without it, you're dead.
Yeah. Like pretty quickly.
Yes. Like it does not take long. Like it just, you need to do something about this right now. And that comes up. The next one would be respiration.
Yeah. And that's, I'd say this one's relatively straightforward.
It seems like
from a vital sign perspective. It's counting and how many times per minute. Mm-hmm. So pulse is measured in beats per minute. Respirations are measured in respirations per or breaths per minute. And like it almost seems like it's the most simple out of them. And granted, there's quality aspects to it too. How well are they breathing? Although you're probably assessing that stuff before you counting breaths like that, because that's like the kind of, and we'll talk about assessments in the next episode, but like that is like so important that you start worrying about that stuff before you even start getting vital signs, like the actual numbers.
If they aren't breathing, that whatever is killing you is going to kill you first is what has to be addressed.
Yeah.
If you're bleeding out all over the place from an arterial tear or an injury, you need to deal with that now. If they aren't breathing, you need to deal with that now.
Mm-hmm. So, the things that you're looking for here is how many per minute you're counting.
It's a visual thing.
It is visual, but you can palpate that too. Well, not palpate in the sense that you're pushing in on the chest, but like one of the techniques they told us was like, okay, well, if you're measuring their heart rate, you have their hand up against their chest and you're measuring their heart rate there, their radio pulse on their arm. As soon as you're done with the radio pulse and counting that, you can move right into respirations. And that's a good technique, because when patients know that you're looking at their breathing, they tend to change their breathing.
Yes.
They can't really change their heart rate, but they can change like how quickly they're breathing. And as soon as you ask somebody like, okay, take some breaths for me, I'm going to observe you, they're going to start.
Yes. Breathe normally. I am.
Yeah. This is how I breathe normally. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, you're just taking these deep, slow breaths. And people can't help it. So, respirations, the number per minute and the quality, shallow, deep, labored, noisy, those things we're looking for, right? Easy one, the one that requires no real tools to be able to, you know, to count. Because, by the way, the other two, the beats per minute and the respirations per minute, there is a tool required.
There is.
Which we forgot to mention before. And it's your measurement of time.
Yes. So one of the things that was in the requirements for the class is a watch with a second hand.
It's super important.
It kind of makes sense. Like, you might want to be able to count 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Now, so how many people in that in our class are using their phone?
Oh, I don't know. I wasn't really paying attention, but I assume it's a bunch.
A bunch.
Because most people don't wear watches anymore. No. So that's something that's important. I actually had to change the way that my watch is working because I have a light on the watch. Mm-hmm. And like in darker environments, like I was trying to get pulses and I had to set it so that my backlight would stay on longer for at least 10 seconds. Or sorry, the minimum I would want to stay on is 15 seconds because, you know, if you take anything over 15 seconds, you can multiply it by 4.
Right.
If you take it over 30 seconds, you can multiply it by 2. Mm-hmm. I guess if you take it over 20 seconds, you can multiply it by 3. But who wants to do that math?
No.
But like, you need something to be able to measure time. Yep. Like, that's important. And you need that for both pulse and respirations.
Yes.
The skin, though, doesn't require any tool.
If you walk up to somebody, you are immediately going to be able to see whether their skin looks healthy or not. Now, this does get challenging.
Well, some people just look not great all the time.
This is true.
Some people have an unhealthy look, although that could be their baseline.
That could be their baseline. But yeah, I mean, is it pink, warm and dry? It was basically
that's the baseline of most people. Pink, warm and dry, which I guess some parts of my body are considered pink, but some people aren't pink. The thinner layers of skin, like if you really need to get a sense of how their skin is perfusing, there are areas of the skin that, that are pink, like easier to tell, blood or perfusion through them. So, and I was reading through this, the other day, but like the eyelids, under parts of the eyelids, inner parts of the mouth. So like You can you
and
you,
nail beds
and the nail beds. So you can really dig into those types of things, even on people of different color skins.
Yeah,
like, you know, an African American has darker skin.
Mm-hmm.
And you might look at that and go, well, I can't tell how they're perfusing. No, you absolutely can, because everybody has different parts in it that are thinner, that have more capillaries near the surface. So you can see how their skin is perfusing.
And all of the instructors with the experience that they had basically stated unequivocally, like, you're going to know. Like, you're going to see a patient. You're going to be able to tell visually by their skin if their skin is showing you that they are not healthy.
Yes.
We don't have the experience yet, but I'm sure we'll get there.
Yeah, I think like unusual sweating mm-hmm. is probably like one of the biggest indicators. Sure, like if they're super wet or they're cold and wet
mm-hmm.
when it's not an environment where they should be cold and wet, that's a big indicator.
Yes.
Or hot and sweaty. Like mm-hmm. are they, you know, do they have a fever? Like those are things like
or hot and dry.
And you would think temperature being one of those things, it's like, oh, that's a vital sign. It's actually not. No. The skin, the general condition of the skin and the other vital signs are way more important than temperature, mainly because they're more indicative of how the body's performing mm-hmm. rather than like whether or not it's fighting off like an infection. So,
right.
You know, skin's a really, like, it's the most immediate thing that you'll be able to see as soon as you see a patient on whether, and I think one of the biggest ones, which we didn't mention, is like just general paleness.
Right.
Which, if they are in hypovolemic shock.
Look at you.
Yeah, man. Someday I'll be good with these medical terms. Sorry, everybody. Bear with me. I know, like, I get the concept, but sometimes the words escape.
Yes.
So hypovolemic shock, meaning they do not have the adequate volume of blood in them. That will, you know, they will stop perfusing well, especially on the outer extremities and the skin, and they will look pale,
like a pale gray, pale blue color.
Yeah, like they will look like you're like, hey, that, like, if you ever pictured in your head, like, that person looks like death. That's what, you know,
yeah,
a pale person looks like. I'm pale all the time, so if like, but I guess I'm more pink.
Yeah, you're more pink.
Yeah. So yeah, skin's a really good indicator of how somebody's doing right away.
And then we have pupils. We mentioned this before. Like, how do they react to changes in brightness? Are they reacting the same or differently?
That's the big one. Like, you know, Are they? Well, I think the one is like, are they performing or are they doing the thing that they should be doing in the environment that you're in right now?
Yeah.
So if it's super bright out, if you're outdoors, if it's super bright and you're outdoors, they should be small.
Yes.
Because it's very bright in the sun, and your pupils get smaller the brighter it is.
Yes.
It's like a camera iris for any of those, you know, audiovisual nerds out there. And so it lets in less light. Now, when you go into a darker environment, your pupils get real big.
Because you need more light.
Dark, and you need more light in your eyes. It's actually fascinating how eyes work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, absolutely amazing. So, yeah, like, are they doing that? Or are they outside in broad daylight and they have, you know, pupils the size of dish saucers?
Yes.
Like, that's an indicator of something wrong. Or... Mm-hmm. Are they inside and they have pinpoint pupils and, like, you know, it's bright or it's dark and they're still pinpointed? That's also an indicator of being bad. And then introducing light
mm-hmm.
with a tool.
A pen light.
A pen light. A simple light. It could be any light, I guess.
I mean, I don't think you want to use your 1,000 lumen flashlight.
Oh, no. You
they
definitely
would not
don't.
Appreciate that at all.
One of the students did that to me last night. He was like, oh, let me pull out my EDC flashlight. Like, he's got like it's probably like a Streamlight. I don't know how many lumens,
very
but it was
light.
Not a pen light. It was not like a, like, you know, like we have tools that are pen lights that have like little, indicators on the side of like pupil size. That's meant to be shine in the eyes.
Like 25 lumens, not 1,000.
Yeah. Like, but anything over like 25 lumens, please don't shine it directly into somebody's eyes. He took that thing out and I immediately closed my eyes. I'm like, bro,
here, use mine.
You cannot see this. Like, you cannot see, I can't keep my eyes open for you to see them. So, but the thing that we learned to look for was the reactivity to that light.
Right.
So in a darker environment, you should have very open, like your eyes should be opening. We were in kind of a dark classroom. Mm-hmm. And then as we introduced the pen light, we would look at one eye at a time. And then the we would look for the closing of the iris to react to that new light.
Yeah.
And then we would do it in both eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Because we want to see that they're reacting the same way. Like mm-hmm. that's react equal and reactive. They're reacting the same way and they're reacting the way they should.
Right. And are they equal to each other
mm-hmm.
in both, like when reacting to the stimulus or just at baseline?
Yeah.
So, and like we could go like,
there's a
bunch yeah. of reasons why that could be happening.
Yeah.
Although most of them, I believe, can be kind of qualified into the neurological space. Usually it's a big indicator of some sort of neurological problem.
Even if it's a pharmacology introduction that's causing a neurological problem, yeah, it's still exactly. a neurological problem.
Exactly. So pupils, that's a big one. And then the one that I think we've had the most fun with.
And honestly, like this was one of the things that I was looking forward to because I didn't know how to take one.
I hate this.
He does.
Is blood pressure.
I'm enjoying it.
Although I have a bit of history with blood pressure. I was pre-hypertensive for many years before I got bariatric surgery. And then after I lost a bunch of weight, look at that. I have, whenever I get my blood pressure taken at a doctor's office, I have picture perfect blood pressure, like 120 over 80. I'm like, that's cool. I'm like, you know, you just get to see some results of like the weight loss and stuff. But every time we're in class, I don't know, maybe it's because we're moving around, maybe because I'm stressed, maybe because I hate taking blood pressures I'm not great at it.
Option C.
My blood pressure rises. It's usually like everybody's been getting like 140, 145.
I had one 145 over 75.
145 for you?
For me.
Oh, wow. So you must have been zen-like state at that moment.
I mean, I guess I had calmed down because the initial one was 180 over 100.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the first night I got one from you, it was like
160.
I kept pumping that thing up. I'm not good at it. That's probably like that also has a lot to play in here because like there's a lot of room for error when you start getting the blood pressure stuff.
Yeah.
The like when I was it's like when I'm listening for max and then like pumping up, it's like, okay, I guess I gotta go up to like 200, 210 to get like well above the point where you're like mm-hmm. his normal systolic pressure is.
Yeah.
Systolic being the amount of pressure in the vessels when the heart pumps, like when it contracts, that's the systolic pressure. And then the diastolic is when it's relaxed. Right. So those two numbers make up your blood pressure. So the higher number is the like when it's under pressure, the lower number when it's not under pressure. And you have to get both of them.
We do.
So they taught us the technique for using it using a sphygmomanometer.
Nice. Blood pressure cuff.
Blood pressure cuff.
I have never heard a single doctor or nurse, even in surgical situations, call it anything but a blood pressure cuff.
I've never even heard them call it a blood pressure cuff.
That's what I've always heard.
I've heard them say cuff or BP.
Yeah. Did you get his BP?
Yeah. They don't say blood pressure cuff. Like that's too many, yeah, too like, many
like,
syllables.
But like I've never heard the sphygmomanometer.
You don't think they usually, hey, pass me that sphygmomanometer real quick.
Yeah.
You know? Like, no, they don't. It's but anyway, that's the name of the tool.
It is. It's silly.
Yeah. It's you know.
It's still silly.
There's a reason why they call it a BP cuff. Yeah. It's because it's too long. So the act of getting the blood pressure,
mm-hmm.
this is, it's probably the most complicated by far of yeah. any of the vital sign collection. Right?
Oh, for sure.
Because you have to do a bunch of different things at once.
There's a lot of technique to it.
First off, you need to know the placement of the BP cuff.
Yep.
That's hard enough because that can be interpretive too. Like it tries to tell you on the cuff where to put things, but then, you know, it's like, well, does this arrow go on the center of the bicep? Does it go to the side of the bicep? Basically just read whatever the manual is for that device and listen to your instructors.
Read the manual.
There can be contradictory information on that.
Yes.
So the cuff needs to go on. The cuff needs to be properly sized as well. That could be one of the reasons why I'm getting higher readings in class.
Yeah, so that's one of the things they explained is that if for larger people, us, if they we have a blood pressure cuff that is too small, we'll get a higher reading off of it. So having that properly sized cuff for the individual is hugely important. Or if you have someone that has little twigs, which we, you know, there are people in class that have little twigs, same thing. You're kind of going the opposite direction with it.
Mm-hmm. So essentially what you're doing when you're getting a blood pressure is you are measuring the amount of pressure it takes to tourniquet the arm or mm-hmm. the vessel closed, right? So you're trying to get two numbers. Those numbers are the how much pressure is in the vessel when it's when the heart is pumping and how much is in the pressure when it's relaxed.
Yep.
So there's the way you get that is by the cuff being a calibrated tool that knows exactly how much pressure it's exerting into the or around the arm itself. As that's closing off the artery, as you inflate it with the little bulb, it's mm-hmm. squeezing in on it, right? And so you squeeze it until it stops the blood from flowing through the artery, even when it's when the heart is pumping.
Correct.
So you stop the blood flow, which usually they say it's like 30 millibars of pressure. Oh, I don't know what the actual the number. So like,
so it's millimeters of mercury.
Is it
measured in millimeters of mercury?
Okay.
So if it's so, in other words, if your blood pressure is 140 over 80, then it took 140 millimeters of mercury to on the gauge to shut down right. that pulse.
So 100. So when you're going to 140, so like say a patient's blood gets tourniqueted at 140 millimeters of mercury, that squeezes in and you're supposed to go 30 past that.
Correct.
So that you have a very like significant margin above where that blood is being stopped. And then you have to listen with your auscultation device, your stethoscope.
Yes.
Place it over the radial artery. And then as you slowly release the pressure of the blood pressure cuff, it starts letting air out of the cuff, the needle starts dropping, and then you have to listen for when you could start hearing the heartbeat again through the radial artery.
Which can be a very, very...
Which is
very,
the hardest part.
Yeah.
Absolutely the hardest part. Yep. Where that number starts is like sometimes the hardest thing for me to figure out. And as that needle starts falling, you're listening. And then when you hear a heartbeat, or like that's the hardest part too. Sometimes different people sound different.
I had,
like it could be a light tapping. Yep. It could be like a bass drum. Like I've heard both. All different types.
Yeah.
In just one or a couple nights of practice with different students. Right.
And this is amongst just 16 students.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, I think we got what, 4 sets of vitals last night.
Yeah.
So 4 sets of vitals, I would say I heard it different at least 3 times. 2 people had the same thing. It was a very, very like cook chunk. One girl literally was like a tap on a window
mm-hmm.
where it started.
And like the hard part is like somebody isn't hearing what you're hearing. So I have nothing to compare it to know whether or not that number was the correct one as it's going. So it's hard to get immediate feedback to know if that number that you're getting, that sound that you're hearing is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Because stethoscopes are a pain in the ass,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion. And any little movement or slide of a finger or just the incremental mm-hmm. change of how you're holding that thing can make the loudest freaking sound and make it sound like a heartbeat almost.
And in the tools of the trade tonight, I'm going to talk about one tip that one of our instructors gave us to try and eliminate some of those varying sounds.
Mm-hmm. So like, all right, so to get back to the process, mm-hmm. you're listening as that needle is falling, and the point in which you start hearing the heartbeat again through your stethoscope is your systolic number. Mm-hmm. So if it starts beating again around 140, okay, your systolic pressure is 140. As that number keeps falling, you'll eventually stop hearing that sound again. because at that point it's not exerting any pressure onto the artery, and then it's not going to be pushing up against it, so it's not making the sound anymore. So that is your diastolic pressure. So when the sound goes away, that's your diastolic. Right. So if the sound starts at 140 and it falls and then it trails off at 90, your blood pressure is 140 over 90.
Yep.
And just describing it makes me exhausted.
And then add to that instructors that are playing music.
Yeah.
People that are talking and laughing, noises in the room.
Movement.
Your own assumption that you're an idiot and don't know how to do this.
Well, that's a big one. That's me all the time.
There's a lot of things going on, and like I cannot imagine. I mean, we're going to do a lot more of it, obviously. They've kind of presented like you're going to be doing this a lot. So we get a lot more practice with it. But I'm assuming when you get into the back of an ambulance and there's sirens going on, and you're bumping over a road, it's not going to get any easier.
No.
I would say that we're about the most controlled conditions, even with them introducing different stimulus.
Yeah, we're doing it sitting at desks with the perfect environment. Like, it's mm-hmm. there's nothing uncomfortable about it. When I came home and I was trying to practice with my wife, she's like, do you want me to move? I'm like, no, just stay right there. Because I don't think
still.
If you're on the couch, I'm at a weird angle or whatever. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm probably going to have to learn to get weird angles on these things anyway. So I'm trying to practice the way I would encounter it in the real world. So,
and there's different kinds of cuffs too. Again, sometimes we'll go over in Tools of the Trade.
Yep. So blood pressure.
Yes.
Core skill. Difficult. Probably yes. The most difficult thing I've found
finesse.
About vinyls.
Finesse. It's one of those things that it's going to take finesse. And the only way to get that finesse is to repeat it over and over and over and over.
You got
to
do it a million times. Because like that's what drives me nuts, is seeing somebody get a manual blood pressure so easily. I feel like it's the hardest thing I've tried doing so far. And seeing somebody just take that blood pressure cuff, put it around the arm. They take their stethoscope on like it's a – like they're performing a dance. Like they look so fluid. Mm-hmm. And like I'm sitting there going like trying not to deafen myself because I keep knocking the damn the bell of the stethoscope into the desk because I forgot to take it out of my ears as I take the blood. Like I feel like I'm a gangly idiot.
And by the way, making sure to put the stethoscope on the correct way, which I wasn't doing for the first few times. Like, why can't I hear anything? Oh wait, I know.
Yeah, there is a directional aspect to stethoscopes.
Yes.
They angle forward. Like if you're wearing it, they angle, like if you're putting putting them in your ears, they angle forward towards your eyes.
Yes.
Like that's important or else they don't fit in your ear canal.
Yeah. Trust me, you won't hear anything.
But blood pressure.
Yep.
I'm sure we'll talk about that more.
I have no doubt.
Podcast. But I got to practice. And that's really the takeaway.
Yes. Like
practice, 100%. Practice, practice. How do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Learn how to play an instrument or be very funny, but mainly do it over and over and over again.
The answer is practice. Like that's the,
I was trying to find an answer other than practice, but he's not wrong.
So, all right. Next up, temperature.
Yeah.
Which we talked about. It's not technically a vital sign, but it is something that we can measure for, obviously with a thermometer. It's the one that we're probably all most familiar with. There's different types of thermometers. Yeah. I don't think we need to go too deep into thermometers.
Definitely not. Main thing is like if they're dry and you touch them with the back of your hand and they're hot, like acknowledge the fact that they're hot, you know?
Well, yeah. And while it is important to be able to take a temperature, really, it's just like, what do you know what the signs of a serious temperature are? Because a lot of people may have elevated, like, and you know, temperature is a range thing.
100%.
So somebody's baseline might be a little low all the time, might be a little high all the time. But basically, once you start getting over like 103 or below 97, like when they start, you know, kind of exhibiting signs of hypothermia or severe fever, those are the red flags, right?
Yep.
And then we have
the extras,
the cool stuff, things that are really good mm-hmm. to know, but not necessarily always within the scope of EMT, because like the core skills are the ones we talked about already.
Yeah.
These ones are extra. I think the biggest one being pulse ox.
100%.
I feel like that's going to be on every call people are going to, because it's so easy.
Yeah.
And it gives you a bunch of information at once, because when you put on a pulse oximeter, it doesn't just give you your SpO2, which stands for the something I don't know off the top of my head.
Saturation. Isn't it saturation of oxygen?
Yes.
In the blood?
Yes, exactly.
I don't know what's SP, like SP.
Man, we should really look these things up.
Hey, before. If you know what that answer is, please comment below.
Tell us we're idiots. Yeah, SpO2 is the percentage. Oh, is it?
Saturation percentage of
O2. Nice. Look at that. Look at that. We figured it out. So how much percentage, like basically there's 100% is how much oxygen could be carried in the blood at any one time. The potential. And then it measures for like how much oxygen is attached to red blood cells as they're flowing through mm-hmm. the blood. It does this through light and through the skin, and it's super, like, it's magical. Basically, there's little elves inside this device that you stick onto the end of the finger.
Yeah.
And they magically count every single one of those.
Can you get cookies from those elves? Or do they, is that
no, it's wrong off? It's a different union.
Got it.
They're measuring the red blood cells as they go around and how many of those red blood cells have oxygen attached to them.
If you think about technology, it is one of those things where for $25 from Amazon, you can buy this thing that tells you this magical number without having to plunge or penetrate your skin in any way. It's pretty freaking cool.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. So it's and as a matter of fact, most like wearables, like the kind of stuff like my watch, mm-hmm. will kind of give you your SpO2 as well. How well your blood is, you know, delivering oxygen, which is crazy.
It's cool.
You see it all the time. But this is something that just simply goes out of the finger. And the nice thing about it, too, is that it also gives pulse.
Yes.
So you don't have to constantly be checking or palpating for a pulse, although that is the golden standard. Same with blood pressure. Getting a manual blood pressure mm-hmm. is often considered to be the gold standard.
What do they keep on saying? Treat the patient, not the device?
Yes. They keep saying treat the patient, not the results. Mm-hmm. So regardless of what you're getting in the numbers, and this is more of a general rule, mm-hmm. you should be making sure that the patient is being cared for, not just treating. The thing that they specifically started, they used was like the pulse oximeter, mm-hmm. which is especially easy to try to, use to like limit out other problems. So if like, and basically, if your pulse ox is above 94, I think is the mm-hmm.
94 to 100.
94 to 100 is considered to be normal.
Yep. Although,
like, so if it's above 94, you're generally basically moving oxygen well in your blood.
Right.
Doesn't mean that you're necessarily perfusing well. You could have other problems going on, and there could be misreadings on that device. But it doesn't mean that just because that number is above 94, you shouldn't then go, oh, well, they're breathing fine. If patient is still having trouble breathing, you should address that. You should give them some oxygen, or you should help them and figure out why they're having trouble breathing. It's not just about the number that's on that little device.
Correct.
So, it'll tell you how well they have oxygen moving through their blood, whether it's normal, whether they're hypoxic. Although you can find out if somebody's hypoxic through other ways too, skin being one of them. You know, the cyanosis is one of the kind of big signs of mm-hmm. of hypoxia. That's the bluing of the lips and like fingertips and stuff. And then kind of a descending scale of red flags. So like normal, hypoxic, significant hypoxia is kind of like below 90%, and then severe is below like 85%. Patients with emphysema, I believe, and other chronic lung diseases,
COPD,
may have a baseline that is chronically low.
Yeah, I think they said like 88 to 92 or something.
Right. So them being in the high 80s may not be as big of a red flag, although it does mean that they're not moving oxygen well enough, but that may be their baseline.
That might be their historical historical baseline.
Yes.
Like what they normally are on a daily basis.
And things like carbon monoxide can throw off, because carbon monoxide mimics oxygen, and is more, it is stickier basically to mm-hmm. red blood cells. So it'll replace the slot that oxygen has in the red blood cell. and the SpO2 meter or the pulse oximeter will read that as oxygen. So right. if somebody has carbon monoxide poisoning, it'll throw off a typical pulse oximeter by saying, "Oh yeah, they have great oxygen levels," when that can all be replaced by carbon monoxide, which is bad.
Hence the reason, if they're not breathing well, and this is saying they're normal, you still need to treat the fact that they're not breathing well.
Yep. So then we have a couple other tools, yep. Blood glucose.
Which is more common. I mean, the reality is our American diet, type 2 diabetes is more prevalent than ever. It's just a fact. So I think as we go along, we're going to encounter – I'm guessing that we're encountering that more now than, say, 20 years ago, just because of the kind of the trend. So I think it's one of those things where we're going to see it more and more. We're going to see it be taken more prevalently. Just a guess, but
yeah. So I think that's – we haven't gotten into how to take blood glucose yet.
We have not.
In class. I'm sure we will, but it's an important one to know because it can be a factor in, I think the two things that they've kind of told, or the two things to look for in terms of blood glucose levels, as an EMT in Pennsylvania, it may be different if you're listening in a different state. We're allowed to take it if they are exhibiting stroke-like symptoms, mm-hmm. or have an altered mental status.
Right.
I guess because both of those things can mimic or have, the complications can be caused by low or high blood sugar that mimic those other things.
And if they're low, that altered mental status is scary. I've been around it a few times.
Yep.
It is something you have to... You have to identify, and if they are altered, you have to make sure that you're making sure that that's not the reason why.
Yep. So the thing to keep in mind here is like blood glucose can shift. It shifts in everybody throughout the day. Everyone has like a graph. Their blood sugar goes up and goes down, but the typically it should be in the 70 to 100 range, somewhere around there.
Right.
And if it goes lower than that, that's dangerous because that's when the body starts shutting down. And then it can go way, way higher than that. And on a chronic level, I believe that's when it causes more problems over time.
Yeah.
If it's that high all the time, but those are things that we need to look out for. We need to know how to take them and how to look for them. And then the last one we talked about, which I don't even really know much about. They mentioned it. It's capnography, which is measuring the levels of carbon dioxide in the exhalations.
Right. So it was a little device that would go on. We covered BVM, ball valve masks before. Bag valve masks before. And you would take a reading off of either the tube that's in the mouth or off the mask that's on the mouth. On their exhalation, you get a number.
As the patient exhales, it measures the amount of carbon dioxide in what they're exhaling, the gases that they're exhaling. If it's and that level of CO2 can be interpreted to basically give performance of how well the body is exchanging oxygen and CO2. That's about as much as I know.
Yeah, we haven't really they mentioned it. Because it was part of respiration, but they really haven't delved into it at all.
And it's not necessarily within the scope of an EMT.
Right, I think it's ALS.
Yeah, getting a little higher level there.
Yep.
So, that's it. That's all we learned in vitals.
Just a few things. I mean, it's not much.
Yeah, it's not like it was a total dump of information and then trying to figure out how all this stuff
now do it comes to music.
Into a larger picture. Do it to music.
Do it to music.
While moving.
Yes.
In the corner, tucked under a couch or something like that. So that was all like, obviously we sat through lectures learning that from slides.
Yay.
But it was paired with some good stories and instruction from the instructors themselves. And then to Max's point, the fun stuff was, okay, everyone get up and basically round robin getting vitals from everybody.
Yep. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. That's
I always do.
It is fun. It is. I do find that to be a lot more, it helps me remember stuff a lot better.
Oh, for sure.
Doing it by
getting my hands on things,
muscle memory.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's really kind of everything we went through in vitals, right?
Yeah. I mean, there was one night where they were showing some cool techniques on how to secure a stethoscope to be able to take readings while they're all bundled up. That was kind of cool.
And a trauma patient.
Yeah, extra skill session, which was really neat. But yeah, that's pretty much, sums up what we did with vital signs.
And I think the biggest takeaway, or one of the biggest takeaways, which they reiterated many times, is like, yes, there are devices that you can use to get automatic readings. You can use a pulse oximeter to get pulse. You can use an automatic blood pressure cuff, which is usually attached to a heart monitor, which is usually attached to the pulse oximeter, which then could have a thermometer on it. Like, there's that box of magic that collects all of that information, and then like can also act as a defibrillator, the heart monitor. That thing is awesome.
But you could also be down a ditch, upside down in a car, trying to do all these things.
And none of it compares to the simple skill of knowing how to get all of that information yourself in the moment. Yep. Like, you will not always have that amazing device that connects all the dots together for you. You have to do that.
No, you have to have these basic skills. I mean, it's like, I don't care what it is. I don't care what trade it is. I don't care what you're learning. There are basics you have, fundamentals you have to get down that are going to be that foundation for everything you're going after that. And this is one of those things.
Yeah. There's no shortcuts.
No.
There's no free meals. Let's put it that way. So you have to learn the vitals. You have to be able to get proficient at those techniques. So with that, why don't we talk about this week's tool of the trade?
So tools of the trade, we did
not go, that we haven't talked about it a bunch already.
We went a bunch of information about how to use it, how we used it in class. So I'm not going to repeat everything for you. Mike was very, very detailed in his description, which is awesome. There are different types of sphygmomanometers. There is ones we were using, which uses mercury, millimeters of mercury as the measurement for the pressure. There's also one that is an aneroid sphygmomanometer, which does not use any mercury.
Oh, okay, cool.
But apparently they also require a lot more calibration. By the way, they all require calibration, and we learned the one night that there's a little tool that comes with it that helps you do this.
Yeah, you should know how to do that because the needle needs to be within the calibration box. Right.
So on your gauge, it's a gauge. It goes from zero and the numbers go up. They go
usually up to like 300 or something like that.
But at the very bottom, depending on what brand you have, some have a little bold black mark. Some have a box. That is your zero reading. And you have to be able to calibrate that to put you at zero. Otherwise, your reading could be off.
Yeah. When there is no pressure in the cuff, the reading has to be at zero or whatever that indicator inside is of it, in that box.
So basically what you would do is the gauge itself, you pull the rubber tube off because there's rubber tubes that lead to not only the bulb that you increase pressure with and release pressure with, but you also have a rubber tube that goes to the gauge. And when you take that gauge off, there's a spot where that rubber connects where you have a small tool that you can basically zero out that gauge.
It's not at zero.
And that's really important because, again, it could throw off your reading that you're getting. And also there's another type of sphygmomanometer, which is the automatic. Mm-hmm. They're very common. Generally, I've seen them as simple as just this Velcro thing that goes around your wrist and it inflates and tells you what the magic numbers are. I have found them to be very questionable at times. And obviously we have things that are going to be in the ambulance that are going to do it automatically as well.
Which are probably a lot more accurate.
I would assume.
Than like the one that you could buy at Walmart that goes around your wrist.
One would certainly hope so.
Mm-hmm.
Also a couple other things. So there's a couple tips that they gave us being the professionals they are. One of the things you can do is when you get that blood pressure cuff, it's going to have the two tubes. By shortening the tube that leads to the gauge itself – so that you can still use the gauge to clip onto didn't talk about that. So in the back of the gauge on some of these have a little alligator clip. And that's designed to either clip onto a band that's on the cuff itself or to on a piece of clothing, because sometimes you're not going to be able to get onto that little strip that's there that's meant for it, simply because you may be covering it with the cuff itself.
Right. And the idea is you can move that gauge around.
Exactly.
So that you can see it.
Which
so
is,
you
don't which have is to important.
Like, so you don't have to like crane your head around underside somebody's arm if that's where the the gauge winds up.
Exactly. By shortening that tube a little bit and not having so much extra length, it can reduce the false sounds you're getting on the systolic number,
mm-hmm.
because you're really listening for that faint sound. And that tube bouncing, rubbing, being hit by you because you're horrible at doing it, all those things can give you false readings.
Yep.
So by shortening that up, it can help. And that was a pro tip they gave us. Also, there was a really cool demonstration on how to stage it.
Yes.
Which was awesome, because if you stage it properly, when you deploy it, you almost automatically can wrap it around, almost like a tourniquet. Same thing. If you have it staged properly, it is immediately ready for use. And the one instructor showed us like one-handed, boom, how he had it ready to go, which was pretty awesome. So like most things, those pro tips are like those little kernels are so
you awesome. Do like those.
I
you do,
love
you,
those.
You love those little tips.
I love it. Because it's a pro tip. It's a pro tip from a guy that's done it 1,000 times.
Yeah, probably more.
So that's the blood pressure cuff, also known as the sphygmomanometer, which hopefully I won't have to say that word ever again. It's a critical tool, and it is one of those tools that 100%, when we described earlier in the episode, you got to get that finesse down. And it is 100% something that needs finesse and repetition to learn how to use.
Yes, I agree. That's great. So yeah, the blood pressure cuff, as we affectionately
from going forward from now.
Yeah, which we will
always known as.
It's a blood pressure cuff. I used to joke with Max when we were first talking about getting those, like before the class, and he's like, "No, I'm not calling it that." I'm like, "That's what it's called. Like, it's on the box." He's like, "No, it's a blood pressure cuff." I'm like, "It doesn't actually say that on the box at all."
It should.
It says sphygmomanometer. Which is the most, cumbersome word to ever say.
And the final section we have, normally we have our wise sage
wisdom
of Jonathan, but tonight Mike is going to give us our student tip.
So this is a pretty simple one for you. The student tip of this week is to put your vitals kit together.
Mm.
I don't know if this is what pros do. I'm just full caveat. Like this is my tip as a fellow student.
As a professional student.
As a, I guess, professional student. But like this is a problem that I was seeing the first few nights of class, because I was just throwing my stethoscope and my blood pressure cuff little package into my backpack, and it was going everywhere. And I was like, oh, well, those things should live together. My pen light was kind of in another pocket. I had my watch on my wrist, but like, I realized that like, if I need to take a set of vitals, they should all be in the same, like all those tools would be really valuable to be in the same place.
Yeah.
So
100%.
My tip is to put together a vitals kit. And I know Max is going to agree with this. We both love making kits.
It's fun. So for those watching.
Yeah. For anybody out there, this is my vitals kit. It'll be a staple for me. It'll live with my medical gear. This is a comprehensive kit of everything that I know right now, or don't really know, but like have been exposed to and can acquire on my own,
mm-hmm.
tools to be able to get information on a patient's vitals. There's a bunch of things in here. I will quickly go through just the items that I've put in. Right at the top is a reference card. I got this off of Amazon. It has a reference of different vital signs on it. It's like an EMT cheat sheet, because I don't know all this stuff yet.
And you got it attached to some kind of a keeper.
It's like a little keeper on there. It came that way. Right as I open the kit, I have a headlamp.
Should be in everything.
This is a Princeton Tech headlamp. I love these things. It has a red, a green, and a blue light on it. The blue is great for nighttime stuff because you can't see blood under a red light.
No, you can't.
But you can see it under blue or green. Right at the top here, I have an extra watch.
Okay, so he really went maybe above and beyond even what I was going to do with his kit.
Well, if my watch is broken, I still need a watch. You do. Like, I need a way to get pulse rate.
I'm not disagreeing with it. Yeah, it's just so, I wouldn't have gone there. I'm impressed.
Yeah, I need so I have an extra watch in here. I obviously have my stethoscope. And on here is a roll of medical tape, just because that seemed like a good place to stick it for right now. Pen light for checking pupils. A pad and pen, which is super important. You should be able to write the vitals down. Yeah. Like, just remembering them will never happen. You got to write them down. You got to have a pen and paper in the kit. I have a few sets of gloves.
Yep.
I have my sphygmomanometer in this little carrying case here, which is, staged correctly per what we were taught in class. Yep. I did love that tip. That was cool. I was like, oh, how does this? Oh, that's perfect. That's a great way to put this thing back in here. Some more gloves. I have multiple sets of gloves in case I need to get vitals off of multiple people. I have a set of shears because sometimes you may need to. Well, first of all, it's free, right? You know, these things are like a few dollars each. And I stick one in the bag in case I need to cut open someone's jacket to get to their skin to be able to get a blood pressure. Right. Makes you sense. Can't do it over bulky clothes.
No.
I have a temporal thermometer.
My sir.
Which is, it's not as good. It's not as accurate as, say, a oral thermometer or a rectal thermometer, but it's a little bit less invasive than
one of those.
By the way,
don't confuse the rectal and oral thermometers.
Well, I guess you can confuse them, but just don't do it a second time.
Once.
Yeah. When they're brand new out of the package, I guess it really doesn't matter.
I mean, it's one, they're the same
thing. It's only an anal thermometer after you use it where it's supposed to be used. But yeah, temporal thermometer, which is a bit more bulky than I was hoping for it to be. Cause like a lot of this stuff takes up a lot. This takes up a
medical stuff fills space fast.
Yep. Pulse oximeter.
Yep.
Like these things, you can get them dime a dozen now off of most sites. And they're from what I hear, they're pretty accurate. I do have a cheater wrist mounted automatic, blood pressure monitor here. I don't know how accurate it is, but I figure if I need to multitask, it's better than nothing.
So, I would agree with you.
So a wrist mounted sphygmomanometer, automatic sphygmomanometer, nestled in there is also a pack of AAA lithium batteries because several of these items here take batteries, and I don't want to not have them available. I have a little package of gauze and this is alcohol pads, mainly for using the blood glucose meter because this requires using lancets to create a little basically cut on the skin, a little poke, which you can draw blood from, which then you could put into the test strips to put into the blood glucose meter, glucose meter. And that requires a few things with it, including lancets and test strips. So all that lives in this little kit that it came with, which is great. And then I think that's everything. So, I mean, all of that fits here within, this is a toiletry kit pouch.
Toiletry
bag from special operations equipment. It's like the perfect size to fit all of this stuff.
And bright friggin' orange.
And it's in bright orange. And I'm going to put some labels on it and stuff too, so I can figure out where it is. But that's more of like a, you know, staging your medical gear type of thing. But I wanted to put it all together so that when I needed it, not just for class, because I assume someday I'm learning these skills so that I can figure this stuff out to help somebody. So if I'm going to do that, I want all that stuff in one place so that I can do what I need to do and have all my gear staged.
I copied him straight up. I was like, that's a great idea. When he said what he was doing and what he was putting in, and I was like, oh, that's awesome.
So yeah, that's your tip for the week.
There's your tip.
When you have your stuff,
as good as Jonathan, maybe better.
No, Jonathan's way better than I am. As a matter of fact, make sure you send us a note. Let us know how we did without Jonathan. Hopefully you still enjoyed the episode. We know that Jonathan's the draw. He's at least the handsome one.
Oh, he's pretty. He's got that southern
accent. He does have that southern drawl, that Virginia kind of accent there. I enjoy him.
The voice of our founding fathers.
He's a good dude. I like him a lot. I won't ever say that to his face, though.
No, we can't do that.
No, that can't be complimentary to our friends. But yeah, so that's our episode for this week, talking all about vitals.
Yes.
Core skill. Got to do it.
Yep.
You got these, this is super important. And then there's obviously a reason why we learn it early-ish in EMT school is because
we're already repeating it.
Yeah, we got to repeat it over and over and over again.
Yep.
So thanks for taking the ride with us, and we'll see you next time on the Ride Along. This podcast is for educational and storytelling purposes only. It is not medical advice or official EMT training. Always follow your accredited instructors and local protocols. Heartbeats racing it over.